From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. The poorest among us are at the highest risk for certain chronic and life-threatening diseases. Complicating matters, many of our neighbors living in poverty in Western New York have limited access to health care, both preventative screenings and expensive treatments to keep conditions under control. The situation is not without hope. Many of the guests in studio today work to help those among us at higher risks for diabetes, asthma, miscarriage, death in infancy, toxic stress, and certain types of cancer. This hour, we take a closer look at poverty-related disease. In the studio with me today, I have Dr. Matt Devine of Highland Family Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
We have Candace Lucas from URMC's Center for Community Health. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
And Lorinda Parks, Dr. Lorinda Parks from Jordan Health. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks. We're excited to talk about this topic.
Well, you know, in the last hour, we were talking about the Affordable Care Act. And one of the main points of the Affordable Care Act was to get more people having access to health care. These groups are some of the groups of people that the Affordable Care Act was meant to recognize. Now, the vast majority in New York State that got in the New York State of Health Exchange came in under Medicaid. People who didn't have insurance before now have insurance through Medicaid, and there are many people who also got subsidies. So a lot of these people who are in the poorer categories are getting help. Now, is the Affordable Care Act, and this is a premature question, right? Maybe. Is the Affordable Care Act really doing what it needs to help people, especially in this first year? What is your perspective, Lorinda Parks?
Thanks. So I'm from Anthony Jordan Healthcare Center, and Jordan has traditionally just been one site, but now is up to 10 sites. And so we see a broad base of these patients who are really needy. We were seeing a large chunk of patients who had no insurance at all. And with the Affordable Care Act, though, some of those patients now qualify to be on Medicaid. We've seen a reduction, just a small reduction in our self-pay population, but we've seen a great reduction in the people that have insurance. And those people are way more likely to come in for preventative services. They're not going to wait until their face is extremely inflamed with a huge dental abscess. They're going to come in earlier. And they're likely to get their health screenings, which is going to help us reduce late-stage things like late-stage breast cancer. So we're able to see them earlier. We've actually enrolled 1,100 people in the first year that we've seen at Jordan, and we are continually enrolling people. We are very hopeful that this is going to make a difference.
Okay. And from your perspective, Candace Lucas, what do you think that the Affordable Care Act is making a difference, or is it really too soon to tell?
I think the Affordable Care Act is going to make a difference. It's important for people to have health care. However, we know that that is not the panacea, that there is still more that needs to be done. People who have not had health care before, they don't know how to navigate this system. So just giving them health insurance does not mean that they are going to have access to care, that they're going to understand what they need to do, or that they're going to follow through with it. We've known over the past decades that even people who had health insurance did not always do what we thought they should do as far as their preventive screenings and so forth. So I think the first year, you talked about the number of people that got Medicaid. That was 93% of the people got in through Medicaid. They were first time to health insurance. They're going to need to have a lot of education still about what this insurance means. It's a complex system. They have to understand high deductibles, low deductibles, co-payments, when do I pay, when don't I pay, what health provider is in my plan, where can I go for services. There are just so many things still to be answered that I think it's too soon to really tell what impact that's going to be. And there's also some thoughts that people who got health insurance the first year maybe drop the second year because they don't understand the whole recertification process. So there's still a lot of education out there that needs to be done.
Now, Dr. Devine, do you see things about the same way, or do you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think our practice is also an urban practice similar to the Jordan sites. We also have an ongoing partnership down the road with St. Joe's, which is traditionally works with people that don't have the insurance yet. But I think, you know, we often are seeing people once they are insured, they're kind of coming into our doors, and we've seen significant improvements in that since we've started. But I agree with Candace that, you know, it's not so much just to get somebody into healthcare. It's really a avenue of once they're in, how can we help them to navigate that? And so a lot of the things that have come really over the last 5 years have been hiring people like nurse care managers and having, you know, social workers full-time, having behavioral health therapists working in your practice to really help kind of facilitate this process, and kind of using all of those individuals in a team-wide effort to really get the patients more engaged and get them working on self-management tools that they can kind of take to them with them to home and with their families. But that's an ongoing process. But I think obviously getting insurance is a really good start to that.
Go ahead. If I may, I don't want us to forget about the thousands of people who will still be uninsured even after, you know, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. There are people that we really need to reach out to that still do not, may not have the wherewithal, may not understand the urgency. They've gone for years without having health insurance. So, you know, what is the reason for getting it now? There are still going to be thousands and thousands of people that do not have health insurance.
And well, that's the key to a one access point location where they can come. If they don't get insurance, they still can be seen. If they do possibly qualify and they don't know, there's going to be people there that are financial experts that can help sit them down, talk them through this to see, do you qualify? What are my options? Which exchange plan should I choose? And so having that single access, for instance, where they can come and get all of that information, they just walk in the door and they can have help, is really key.
Yeah, and that's part of what we were talking about in the last hour, and what you mentioned, Candace, that a lot of it is about education. A lot of people don't realize that there is another enrollment that's going on right now until February 15th. And a study that just came out today from Kaiser Health News that said that the majority or a large portion of the uninsured, about a quarter, they didn't think that the insurance policies that were available to them were affordable. Now, some of these people haven't put a lot of time into researching what those things are, what their subsidies are, but a lot of people who have, and people who've spoken to me, you know, through our Affordable Care Act, understanding the Affordable Care Act project, people have reached out to me and said, you know, I got it and I just couldn't afford it anymore. You know, my car broke down and I had to use the money for that, and now I'm no longer insured. So these things are going to constantly be an issue, and we could talk about that, and we'll be talking about that more in the coming days. But I do want to talk about this poverty-related disease, and there are many of those. And usually when you hear poverty-related disease, you hear it, you know, on PBS talking about things in the third world. But these are issues that affect us here in Rochester right now. On PBS just last week, there was that special America by the Numbers looking at the high rates of infant mortality in Rochester that are double what we see on the national level. I know that Anthony Jordan is trying to help people, especially with prenatal care. But really, what are we facing as far as infant mortality and miscarriage among the poor in our area?
And premature delivery. So we know that stress, maternal stress, is probably one of the key factors to premature delivery. We don't have an exact reason examples of what stress would cause it. Some people are resilient to those forms of stress, but overall, higher stress does make you more at risk for preterm delivery. We've started a new project at Jordan, but at several other sites around Rochester, as well as a group effort to do a project called Centering Pregnancy, where we meet in pregnancy groups. For instance, everyone that's due in April, maybe 10 women, will sit around together and get 2 hours of prenatal care every month rather than your typical 15-minute visits. We see this as being a real benefit because the women are giving each other the strength that they need. And the data shows nationwide that Centering Pregnancy groups reduce the premature delivery rate. And that's why they're getting federal dollars to be able to keep spreading this plan. So we know that that's something we can do right here in Rochester, having women meet together in groups, reduce their stress, and reduce this premature delivery. We all know inherently that having a baby born early is going to cause significant health concerns for that child going forward. So we're excited about that project, but the gap is very large, and it's based along not just poverty, but debt definitely along racial lines here in Rochester.
So, Dr. Matt Devine, can you talk to me a little bit more about the situation with stress? I mean, it seems to me a very high bar to set that we're going to reduce the stress levels of people who are poor.
I think you're exactly correct. That is the challenge that we're being faced with now, is psychosocially, socioeconomically, we are continuing to be indebted with all kinds of inopportunities to try to manage our health, our families, and to try to really make our way in this complicated 21st century. So a lot of that, I think, really comes down to what supports can we give individuals, especially those in a low socioeconomic status. What can we give them to help them succeed? What do they need? And when we talk about kids, obviously we want help at home, and we're going to continue to work on education for parents and guardians. But it doesn't stop there. I mean, obviously children go to school. There's community services that are around that are available. And there also needs to be a link between the clinicians and the physicians' offices in which they're involved with, back to them and through the community. So what opportunities can we spread around through the county? And these are opportunities that come up all the time that I think can make an impact. Ultimately, you're exactly correct. You know, we talk about the graph of where the United States is as compared to its health across the world, and how much money we spend and how little and poor our outcomes are compared to other countries in the world. But another asset to that graph that often isn't there is how much money do we spend on mental health services. And we actually could do a lot better, but we in fact do provide a lot of funds, but we need to do better with that, because I think that's the underlying piece that for many, many years has not been addressed. And if we don't continue to kind of tackle that head on with helping to bring that to the fold, then physical health issues are going to be affected by this mental health issue that you can't see. It's not like the cut that you put the Band-Aid on.
Candace Lucas, this relationship between mental and physical health, it is something that we hear a lot about, that we don't put as much effort into taking care of the mental health of all Americans, basically. And then you've got that compounded situation where you're not dealing with, you know, diagnosable mental illness, but just everyday stresses that can get to the point of being toxic. Is there anything we really can do?
You know, we were talking about this a little bit before we came in, just how stressful people's lives are. I mean, we all have stress, and we all, you know, it's about managing that stress, but it's this constant, unrelenting stress that we really have to look at. And we were just talking about kids, you know, the environments that they live in, and stress being a factor in childhood development, and how much schools play in that. Just walking from home to school is a stressor for our children. You know, how many times are they going to be harassed by, you know, different elements on the street just before they get there? A mile walk. And then once they get into schools, looking at the metal detectors, just knowing that you have to walk through a metal detector is stressful, whether you have something on you or not. So we really have to think about these issues of stress. And I think it's so important that we're talking about poverty in place, because place matters. I'm also chair of the African American Health Coalition, and we released a report this year, the What's Going On report, where we talk about the fact that place matters. We look at health care, you know, maybe personal choices and lack of health insurance, but we don't spend enough time looking at the environmental factors that play a large role in the health of our community, and especially in the health of the lives of people that are low income disenfranchised and marginalized.
I think it's interesting when you're talking about that place matters, because that's one thing I wanted to mention is that poverty exists in, you know, in urban Rochester. There's a high rate of poverty. But in very rural areas surrounding Rochester, you also have high rates of poverty. And those people are still also at risk for certain diseases associated to poverty. We've talked about some of the possibilities, some of the options that people have in the urban centers, but what are the options for people who are, live in rural parts of New York?
I think Candace is absolutely right when she's summarizing that for kids, school is really one of the most important places that we can reduce stress. There was a great report from 2012 in the New England Journal of Medicine by Dr. Stapleton that showed that by pre-adolescence, by fifth grade, health disparities already existed among kids who were going to school in a stressful environment versus kids that were not going to school in a stressful environment. And as a physician, I can only do so much in my clinic, but I feel like I need to be an advocate for both how housing, which we haven't yet touched on, but definitely affects people's health care, and the school environment, that whether they're seeing non-aggressive behavior at school, but somewhat violent behavior, whether they have discrimination in their class, whether they perceive their own health to be poor, these things are allowing them to measure extremely poorly on their sense of health and on their actual health by the time they're in fifth grade, and so are already behind. Whereas kids who went to a school where they were able to reduce this amount of stress, whether it be a rural area or an urban area, because we know that there is stress in both areas, the isolation in a rural area can be very stressful for kids. So if we take an important look at our schools and try to reduce some of this environmental stress at school, we can have a leg up on their health. And isn't that an interesting and exciting opportunity for us?
Yeah, I don't think that these are things that you could really make a comparison of, but someone did mention to me that, you know, maybe people in rural areas are at a disadvantage because in the urban centers, there are a lot of projects, there's a lot of centers, and there's a lot of programs for outreach, whereas in some of the rural areas, we don't have as much of that. What do you think of that?
That's true. The one piece that the rural area has going for it in general is that they don't have as many people of minority status, and we can't forget that these health measures are particularly bad for our minority communities. And so poverty does play a role, but it is particularly our communities of color who are really struggling. And African Americans are very disproportionately struggling with environmental stress, for instance, and how that affects their health. And Candace was definitely highlighting that in her report about the numbers in Rochester. It is clear that it is African American folks who are really struggling.
Yeah, African Americans and Latinos are at higher risk for many of these poverty-related illnesses. Can we suss out whether this is related more to race or more to poverty, or it's a multi-factored situation? Let's start with talking about diabetes.
Yeah, well, it definitely is multi-factored. Race does matter and place does matter. And so when you put those together, you know, that accounts for these health disparities and poor outcomes. You know, when you're looking at, be it diabetes or high blood pressure or cancer, all of heart disease, all of these things, African Americans and Latinos have worse outcomes for. As a matter of fact, in Monroe County, cancer is the number one killer cause of death, and it's number one for Blacks, Whites, and Latinos across the board. In looking at our Place Matters report, one, lung cancer, of course, is the main killer in there. And when you're looking at these areas of poverty, when you have more outlets for tobacco sales, right? Now, granted, people can get lung cancer without ever smoking, but, you know, when you have all of these corner stores and places where people can, you know, they're marketed to and they can buy cigarettes so easily, at any point, you see that that plays a part. When you don't have grocery stores that are selling affordable, healthy foods, that plays a part. When you don't have places, green space, or areas that you feel safe being physically active, all of that plays a part. And so these are some reasons why these diseases are higher in our areas that are most impoverished.
Dr. Matt Devine, when it comes to diabetes, for example, what are some of the things we talked about? You know, there are some genetic dispositions. You mentioned food deserts, not having the nutritious food available to you. What are some of the other factors that are contributing to high rates of diabetes among the poor?
Well, I think you've touched on the biggest ones, and I do think that it is a bigger problem within the populations of African Americans and Latinos. And I do believe that the city populations, as compared to suburban, are greatly more affected with a higher prevalence of diabetes. And I do think that diabetes is a great topic to cover, because not only is it those with known diabetes, but there is this ongoing swell of pre-diabetes, those that have no idea that they're currently going to develop this if they don't make changes. So we talk about, you know, access to proper food, proper exercise, but really the problem is obesity. And so the access is limited, but it's more of a what are they eating? I mean, we're getting food, but it's not the right types of food. It's not the right types of nutritious foods. So we need to kind of really expand on that to try to help change that behavior. And so a lot of that is cultural. A lot of that is how you've grown up eating certain ways. And a lot of the unhealthy foods, unfortunately, are much more affordable. So that does make it very much more challenging for people. And then obviously, if you live in an unsafe area, you're not going to be outside exercising after school or playing with your friends as much, because it's not safe to do so. So how are we going to kind of change that? How can we make areas and community centers that are safer? And what's the incentive for people to kind of go in and kind of get that activity? We know that they'll feel better. We know that it's getting cold out and that, you know, we're not going to see people till the spring, but what centers can we kind of increase that involvement and get people out? And everyone, I think, will benefit from that.
Absolutely. Well, we have a few callers on the line right now. I'm going to go to line one with Hal in Sparta, New York. And Hal had a comment about the role of churches in taking care of some of this problem.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah. Last Sunday at our First Universalist Church at 150 South Clinton, we had a discussion before the service of reproductive health, and there were several people, including some physicians, present. And that, plus my experience in an inner city as an NIH researcher on issues related to reproductive health, struck me how important churches can be. Our Unitarian Universalist denomination has a program called Our Whole Lives that my own children went through and benefited from, emphasizing every aspect from relationships to the physiology of reproductive health and the responsibility associated with reproduction. And I think that emphasis on planning and contraception and having a healthy family to support children is something that might help. And the second point related to this is, as one of my jobs as the principal investigator was actually following up, visiting homes of dozens of high-risk perinatal families. And it seemed to me that so many of the interventions are related to simple, inexpensive education, transportation, and facilitation that's often lacking in the inner city. The discussion last Sunday was focused on Latino USA did a special report on the reproductive health and specifically how Rochester has such a high rate of infant mortality. So I was wondering if any of the panel members could see how churches might get more involved in perinatal education as well as reproductive education in general.
Thank you very much, Hal. Now, I wanted to direct that question. Candace wanted to answer that question. Do you think that there's a role of churches in this whole communication?
There's absolutely a role for churches. At the Center for Community Health, you know, a lot of the work we do, most of the work we do is around chronic disease prevention. And we do that through collaborations and partnerships in the community. And churches have been wonderful partners with us. Many of the churches have health ministries, so they're looking at how do they help their congregation and their communities live healthier lifestyles. We have a program called Rochester Walks, where churches have adopted routes, and they just get people out there walking in their communities. We have our DPP program, the pre-diabetes prevention program, or diabetes prevention program. Again, that is a church-based program. So churches definitely play a role, and we are happy to have them on board, and we are welcoming even more churches to get involved.
And back to the topic of stress, we know that community and feeling a part of a community reduces stress, and so that's a secondary benefit of being a part of a faith community.
Now, he made a mention of reproductive health, and I just wondered, at Anthony Jordan, he's saying that we need more education, more transportation. You know, what is being done around reproductive health and, you know, before a person gets pregnant and needs that natal pregnancy group?
Absolutely. We really think access is key, and that is access on the day when someone comes in, whether it's a teen or an adult woman. If you come in that day desiring to have contraception, you should leave that day with your form of contraception. So reducing all barriers so that we can get the thing that they need. There's several really good long-acting forms of contraceptive now that you can use for 3 to 5 to 7 years, and these are the things that are helping teens get through to their college education, for instance. And so we really focus on offering those at the appropriate time so that they can have that access. We definitely think that your emotion goes into the type of contraception you choose or not choose. And so providing all of the education available, but also trying to screen for other things that might block you from choosing a form of contraception. For instance, domestic violence or a partner that is trying to put their values upon you, whether it be a parent or your sexual partner or a spouse. And so not only do we try to talk about what the patient is coming in for, but we also try to be a screening advocate for intimate partner violence, because that can make you decide or not decide to choose contraception.
Okay. And you are listening to Healthy Friday on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust. This is member-supported public radio.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, we ask some of the local science community to review a popular new film, Interstellar. What do scientists say about the actual science in the movie? Are wormholes possible? Is that how we're going to discover the future home for Earthlings? The science community breaks it down Monday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Gardner Plus Architects, providing planning, architectural, and consulting services to the healthcare sector and other industries for more than 2 decades. Designing environments for the future, GardnerPlus.com.
Cancer. Yeah, okay. And you are listening to Healthy Friday, right here on Connections. This is member-supported public radio. I'm Michelle Faust, and we're glad you joined us. We're going to go ahead and start this right now, this conversation, with you if you'd like to give us a call at 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. Our first caller right now is Charlene. She's from the city, and she has a comment about education. Carlene.
Yes, I observed yesterday my little kindergartner at doing a Zumba program over at School 12, led by her teachers. This was an after-school program, but it was exciting to see children who were of varying ages, from kindergarten to maybe fifth grade, doing really wonderful exercise for 45 minutes. And one of the things that occurred to me is that we should be doing on a daily basis, or at least three times a week basis, in our schools, a similar kind of exercise program for the young children, so that they have the opportunity to at least get up and get active and get energized every day. And talking to a friend who went to school in Germany, she said they did it every day. And when you had a break in the day, you went outside, whether it was winter or summer, and you exercised outside. So I think we're missing the boat here when we spend millions on education and we stick the children in these seats, glue them to their seats, and do not provide every single day, or every other day at least, that kind of exercise and something that will stimulate them for the rest of their lives.
Carlene, thank you very much. Candace, you seem to have a comment there about education. We talked earlier about the role of schools as far as nutrition and education about certain things. What about exercise?
Yeah, I love what she said. School 12, I'm a big fan. My children went there, so I'm not surprised at all. But she's right. That type of activity is not happening in all of our schools on a regular basis. Sadly, physical activity, recess, is being weeded out of the schools. And I know that some teachers are working hard to try to find ways to get that back into to daily routine. But the problem is that we do not have a comprehensive health curriculum in our schools for our children from grades K through 12. Right now, they may get health education in a couple of grades, but we really need something that's comprehensive from kindergarten all the way up, so children understand the importance of physical activity, healthy eating, stress reduction, all of these things that we're talking about, proper hygiene, how to take care of themselves. And so she's absolutely right. We are missing the boat. When we get millions of dollars into the schools, we really need to think about how do we improve the health education in our schools as well.
Dr. Devine?
I just wanted to echo what Charlene had said, and being a former School 12 member myself, it's nice to kind of hear that schools are trying to think outside the box of trying to get kids involved. And, you know, my wife is a teacher, was at a city school, and with all of the changes in New York State with the Common Core and all of the recommendations that are ongoing, it really is important that the kids have an opportunity to have good focused time to learn, but they do need that time to burn off that pent up energy. And so, you know, the city schools have not been performing well. The graduation rates are not where they need to be. And by making them sit in class more isn't necessarily going to make things better. So I completely agree that we need to give them an opportunity to be kids and kind of burn this off, be active, be healthy, and so that when it is time to learn, they can be more focused with what it is that they need to be learning.
So, you know, schools can play a part as far as prevention, but what happens when a person does get sick? We talked about, it was mentioned before, that cancer is a huge killer when it comes to some of the poorer neighborhoods here in Rochester. Really, how does that happen? Because cancer touches all walks of life, and, you know, every American knows at least one person that's died of cancer or has been affected by cancer. Really, what is the association between poverty and cancer, Dr. Lorinda Parks?
That is definitely true that cancer does affect all communities. However, when we do studies, there's a great study that was put out in Cancer Epidemiology in this year, 2014, that says that there is actually a widening gap in cancer mortality between Black women and white women, and that in fact Black women are slightly less commonly to get breast cancer, but they're way more likely to die from breast cancer. And when we study this issue, we know that there's lots of factors to it, but one of them that's very preventable is breastfeeding your child. So we know that breastfeeding your child is less common in our African-American communities, and that goes directly back to education. And when you do not breastfeed your child, you increase your chance of having breast cancer down the road. And it seems odd that this connection would be, but we have very strong evidence to prove that. And so something as simple as helping to educate our women during their pregnancy about how to care for their child can improve their health long term. We also know that having cancer screening programs like Candace is a part of helps us to find cancers that do exist at a much earlier rate. And then we have a leg up on being able to treat them and help these women survive. So we need to do a two-pronged approach to eliminate this huge inequality between breast cancer in African-American women and white women, education early on, and then screening as soon as we're able to.
Yeah, I believe we've spoken before about breast cancer screenings that are available and that URMC is trying to provide for more women. That's one approach, but what are some of the other approaches that we are maybe missing?
Yeah. Well, no, we do a lot of that through the Cancer Services Program of Monroe County. We are educating women about the importance of getting screened with mammograms, also with clinical breast exams starting at age 21, making sure that young girls know that breast cancer isn't just an older woman disease, but you know, we're finding that 5 to 7% of breast cancers are in women under age 40. So there is a lack of education out there that we try to get done. And then we pay for them, for women that don't have health insurance. So again, having access is important. We try to find ways and days to do breast cancer screenings that may help them not have to take time away from work. So we'll do it on a Saturday. We work with all of our providers around the county to do that, to make access available. And we reach out to women in the suburbs and rural communities as well, because as you mentioned, the education out there might be, they might not have as much and as much access. So we make an effort to get out there into the more rural communities to educate women and do small media advertising. We try to do some larger mass media advertising as well.
Dr. Matthew Devine, can you talk to me a little bit about cancer outcomes for people who have less means?
So I think the biggest thing about outcomes is when they developed these unfortunate diseases, they don't necessarily know how to travel through the system. So there have been some really meaningful studies recently through the medical center about navigating patients through on their way. Once this is diagnosed, there's so many things that have to occur for their care that it can become quite overwhelming. And I think that educational piece is a big part of that as well, because breaking down some of those preconceived notions and prior family rhetoric and history of certain diseases and how you treat them really need to be addressed and kind of brought into the fold. And that takes time. And I think, obviously, stemming back to our getting people insured, that is helps significantly, because now they can actually have the appointments, potentially qualify for the treatments they need. But we still need to kind of continue to build that relationship with people and convince them how important it is for them to come in to the doctor's offices for their preventative visits, so that we can hopefully prevent these things from occurring, because oftentimes, unfortunately, we're finding them after they've already gone on for quite some time. And so how can we get out there and get in touch with our adolescent males and get in touch with our 20 and 30 something year old males? Females are a little bit better about getting in because they do have some annual exams and things like that that they need to have.
Sometimes that's just mindset. I don't know, you know, maybe you've heard it in the people in the room. Someone say, you know, if I don't go to the doctor, then they won't find anything. How do we get past that mindset?
it's all about education and looking at their culture, and that's where the church piece really comes in helpful, because sometimes if you hear that health message about what is going to make you sick from a culturally sensitive perspective, you're going to do better. I really like Dr. Devine talking about navigating the health system and how that can improve your mortality overall. We see that in the disease of HIV/AIDS, and that when patients take their ART, or their antiretroviral therapy, you can achieve a life expectancy now with a diagnosis of HIV that is equivalent to other people. However, we still see a higher minority population having significant disease, death, and illness from HIV. And it's all about adherence to the medications. And that's the piece where the belief system around the medications, the belief system around HIV itself, really either makes or breaks it for these patients with HIV. And so if we can appropriately educate them with their culture in mind, then we can help them get the medications that will suppress their virus to essentially non-detectable.
Is this really something, I mean, these are some of the most expensive medications that exist out there. There's a lot of talk in other countries, in West Africa, about people just not being able to afford the medication that can prolong people's lives, you know, to a healthy, long life. In the United States, it doesn't exist in other parts of the world. But does that exist here? Does that same disparity exist here in Rochester and New York?
Yes, it does. And I'm so glad you talked about that, because we can't forget the importance of the provider-patient relationship. That plays a huge part in whether or not patients are able to adhere to their medications and other prescriptions or directions that are given to them. And we're focusing a lot on people who have a relationship with healthcare, but we have to remember those who have no relationship with healthcare for whatever reason, because of lack of health insurance or geography or whatever the case may be. So it's important that our healthcare providers understand where their patients are coming from, their race, their ethnicity, their cultural differences, the fact that they may not be able to go out and afford all of these medications, that they may not be able to eat the way their doctor is prescribing because that food is not available to them, that they cannot just go out and walk for 10 minutes because they're not living in a safe environment. So again, when we look back at place and how much that matters and poverty, it's important for our healthcare providers to understand that as well.
I think it's interesting that you talk about this relationship. And I know that that's why there are some programs that have these health educators that go out into the community and make that connection. How important is that? I know that there's health educators in several organizations, program that I'm very familiar with, the Promotoras de Salud, that speak Spanish and come into communities, come into homes, and tell people exactly what they need to do in a way that doesn't feel, I don't know, that there's not that distance that sometimes people will have when they come into an office and maybe are nervous to talk to a doctor.
Absolutely. And we talk about that in terms of health literacy, having them understand what their physician's talking about. And a promotor or a peer educator is often able to bridge that gap better and explain exactly what they need to hear in an easy and digestible manner.
Your thought?
And I think that's exactly what we need more of, you know, community health workers, nurse care managers, clinical pharmacists, medical assistants trained with population outreach and management. These are parts of the medical health team that are going to be empowered to kind of help bridge that very gap that we talk about. The communities with churches, other agencies are equally as important, and they're kind of providing work-related individuals to kind of come and bridge that gap as well. And I think what better way to kind of try to meet in the middle? You know, we're all talking about trying to be more patient-centered. So how can we be more patient-centered with an example of trying to make sure that this person takes their medication? If the pharmacy knows they're not taking the medication, but we don't know it as their clinician, shouldn't we have that linkage between each other to try to help kind of break that down and help improve their motivation for taking the medication?
And I want to put a plug in for technology here, because we do learn over time and technology can really help us with that. So we have a program where our HIV patients get an iPod for free, and they're taught from a peer educator how to use the iPod to keep track of their health. For instance, they are able to track their viral loads, track when they need their immunizations, track when they're supposed to take their pills. And this piece of technology is something that they feel comfortable with because they're of a young age where technology is part of who they are. We also find that when we ask patients about psychosocial stressors from a doctor saying, do you have abuse in your home? Do you have people drinking too much? That we don't always get positive answers. And there's great research showing that if you ask them on an iPad, for instance, even if they aren't literate, with someone that's reading the questions to them and they can privately check these boxes, that we're getting much more accurate answers about the psychosocial stressors that are going on in their lives. So I always say work smarter, not harder. And I think technology is allowing us to do that. And as we use that moving forward, it will really benefit our patients.
Wow, I'm imagining someone sitting there in the clinic and playing with an iPad, answering these questions. And really you're thinking that these are better results.
We have some pretty good evidence that they are telling more truthful information to the iPad than they would to your face. And we can then have that information directly inserted into their medical chart so that we know that information.
And you're talking about young people and reaching out to young people using this technology. We have Josh from Brighton, and he wants to talk about young people who don't necessarily think they need health insurance. Josh?
Hi, how you doing? My question is about the Invincibles, basically. I'm actually wondering to what degree are we asking the correct questions about these people, in the sense that maybe they actually do have a difficulty affording the health insurance. Maybe they're in a job that doesn't offer them health insurance and having difficulty finding another. Maybe they've lost health care from their parents' insurance recently, and now they don't have medications to sort of deal with some issues that they have, and maybe they're saddled with, you know, student debt. It seems to be my perception that it's not as easy for some of these people to afford the health care as we assume it is. So that's basically my question.
Well,
to what degree are we actually thinking about it?
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, that was part of the study that I mentioned before by Kaiser Health News is, you know, there are a quarter of uninsured people, this just came out today, that don't think that health care is going to be affordable for them. You know, some of those people have investigated, do they qualify for Medicaid? Do they qualify for subsidies? But there are people who are being offered subsidies who say, you know what? With my other expenses, I can't add this. And this is one thing that we've been asking many of the people who've been answering our survey about the ACA.
I think that's the unspoken piece here, is that we're saying that we can fix this with education, on and on, but the unspoken piece is that money does really matter. And there's a really interesting study. Sometimes you have to look at observations in communities and use it for a research purpose. There was a great Smoky Mountains community where an Indian reservation was going to get some really big kickbacks from a casino, and they were going to give that to the members of the Indian community. So some researchers studied all the families in the community, the ones that were going to get a substantial increase in their income and the ones that didn't. Now, we all know that psychiatric illness is the great equalizer because it does bridge the gap among all these populations. Psychiatric illness can hit all of them. And the studies show that the families that got huge kickbacks, or pretty large kickbacks, up to $9,000 a year per family, were able to reduce the psychiatric illness in their adolescence. So kids 13 to what this caller was talking, you know, early adulthood, 25. And that money alone helped to fix the burden of psychiatric illness. And that's what the caller's speaking about, is that health insurance, you know, maybe you don't have it, but we need to raise minimum wage, for instance, which is going to bring income into the family so that they can either get insurance or whatever they need to do with their money, but decrease the burden. And psychiatric illness is very expensive, and so we would like to decrease the burden of psychiatric illness, and maybe just increasing incomes can do that.
Yeah. Candace Lucas, we are talking about all of these problems associated with poverty. Can we fix them by just giving some people money? Is that the answer?
You know, I
wish that was the answer. It's definitely part of the answer because we're talking about poverty and people need more money. But Josh is right. People can't afford it. Not just younger adults, but older adults that are living in some of these communities. The What's Going On report focused on 8 zip codes in the city of Rochester where 63% of the African Americans in the Finger Lakes region live. And poverty is, it's concentrated, and people just cannot afford the premiums. And they've actually looked at their finances and said, you know what, it's better for me to pay the $95 penalty or even the $395 penalty this year than it is for me to actually try to purchase health insurance.
Dr. Devine, I'll give you the final word. What is this association between poverty, money, and health care?
Right. Well, it's been a while since I've been invincible, but I think the ultimate thing is when you talk about poverty and you talk about that age that people are in the uninsured, most of them are dealing with post-high school education, and we're still dealing with individuals that might not even make it through high school, might not even live past the age of 18 that we're really trying to reach out to, and I completely agree that we need to continue to focus on all age groups, but I think when it comes to poverty and health, we are really on the cusp of kind of making a lot of changes by continuing working on the team and the biopsychosocial efforts that we have in place.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. I am very grateful for my guests in studio, Dr. Matt Devine of Highland Family Medicine, Dr. Lorinda Parks from Jordan Health, and Candace Lucas from URMC's Center for Community Health. Thank you all for being here. And this has been a great hour. If you want to get more follow-up and learn more about what's happening with the Affordable Care Act, with other things that are happening in medicine, do follow our new project, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. There's a website, wxxi.org/ACA. We are multi-platform here. You can hear us here on the radio on Healthy Friday, online, and on WXXI TV, and follow our hashtag, ACAWXXI. And you can follow me at MICHE Reports. Thanks for joining us. We've been talking about poverty-related disease. I'm Michelle Faust. This is Connections Healthy Friday from member-supported public radio.